So Genesis chapter 50, verse 15, we're going to look at Joseph. When Joseph's brothers saw that their father was dead, they said, "Perhaps Joseph will hate us and may actually repay us for all the evil which we did to him." So they sent messengers to Joseph, saying, "Before your father died, he commanded, saying, 'Thus you shall say to Joseph, I beg you, please forgive the trespass of your brothers and their sin, for they did evil to you. Now, please forgive the trespass of the servants of the God of your father.' And Joseph wept when they spoke to him. And then his brothers also went and fell down before his face, and they said, 'Behold, we are your servants.' And Joseph said to them, 'Do not be afraid, for am I in the place of God? But as for you, you meant evil against me, but God meant it for good, in order to bring it about as it is this day, to save many people alive. Now, therefore, do not be afraid. I will provide for you and your little ones.' And he comforted them and spoke kindly to them." The Joseph that we see here at the end of Genesis is very different from the Joseph that we encounter a few chapters before. Joseph, I've always thought, is probably he's the epitome of the spoiled brat. This is a kid that, you know, it's not entirely his fault. It's funny how things, you know, how things, behaviors perpetuate themselves in families. You would have thought that Joseph's father, Jacob, would have learned how destructive it is in a family when a father or a mother favors one child over another. I mean, that's really destructive. And that's how Jacob grew up. Remember Jacob and his brother Esau? His father, you know, God had promised that, you know, he was going to create a great nation through Jacob, through, you know, from Isaac through his son Jacob. But Jacob favored, you know, Jacob was not favored by his father, Isaac. Isaac favored his other son, Esau. His other son, you know, he was the hunter. He was the guy that went out and he hunted game and he brought it back and he prepared the game and he brought it to his, you know, brought it to his father. And, you know, his father, you know, he said, this is my son. I can smell the smell of my son. It's the smell of the outdoors. It's the smell of the open field. And it's pretty clear that, you know, Isaac favored Esau over Jacob. And Jacob, you know, some guys say he was a mama's boy. I don't know if that's true, but he was definitely favored by his mother. His mother very much favored him over Esau, over his brother Esau. But, you know, Jacob, he was the kid that, you know, he stayed close to home. He kind of stayed close to his mom. And his mom favored him, and his father favored his brother Esau. And it was destructive. We see their entire lives, how there's just constant friction, you know, and at one point, Esau, he says that he's going to kill his brother after his brother has stolen his birthright, he gave his birthright away, and then his brother Jacob stole the blessing from him. He said, "I'm going to kill him." And the result is that Jacob ends up running for his life, and he spends most of his adult life in exile. When one parent favors one child over another, it's incredibly destructive. And you would think that Jacob would have learned that. But he doesn't seem to have learned that lesson at all. Because in his own family, he has these sons, and, you know, he clearly favors the two boys who were the children of Rachel, Joseph and Benjamin. You know, he clearly favors them, especially Joseph. Because we know Joseph has a coat. We know it as the coat of many colors. In fact, what it was it was a seamless, long-sleeved robe. And there's something interesting about a long-sleeved robe in that part of the country. You know, it spoke of favor, but it also spoke of the fact that you were not going to be working in the fields. Because that's not how you dressed when you worked in the fields. So here's Jacob. You know, he grew up his whole life with his father, you know, favoring his brother and his mother favoring him. And he ends up doing the same thing in his own family. He favors his son Joseph over all the rest of his sons. Now, I don't know if you've ever lived in an environment like that, but that would not sit well with you if you were one of Joseph's brothers. Now, unfortunately, Joseph, he compounds the problem by revealing to his brothers things that God has shown him, dreams that he's had. He tells his brothers at one point, he says, you know what, I had a dream the other night, and there were 11 sheaves of grain and another sheave in the center, and all the sheaves, you know, the 11, they all bowed down to the one. Well, his brothers knew what they were talking about, and they're like, what? You think we're all going to bow down to you? You're the baby. You know, big deal that dad loves you more than anybody else, but we're not bowing down to you. And later on, he tells them about another dream. He says, I had another dream. I had a dream how the sun, moon, and the stars all bowed down. That even got his father wound up. He says, what? Not just your brothers, but your mother and I? We're going to bow down before you too? We know that Joseph was a tattletale. He would run and he would tell his father about anything that his brothers were doing, getting them in trouble. And the kid was kind of a brat. Now, eventually, his brothers decided that they were going to take matters into their own hands, and you guys know the story. At one point, they see Joseph coming, and all they can think is, yeah, here he comes again. And they start to talk to each other, and he says, here comes this dreamer. Here's what we're going to do. We're going to kill him. We're going to kill him, and then we're going to make it look like it was an accident. We're going to make it look like he was attacked by a wild animal. And, you know, the oldest, Reuben, he's thinking, well, we can't do this. You know, let's throw him in a pit. Throw him in a pit. And he's thinking, later on, I can come back and I can get him after the rest of my brothers have cooled off. But that's what they do. They throw him into this pit. And while Reuben is away, some Ishmaelites, traitors, they're coming by. And the rest of the brothers are thinking, hey, why should we kill our brother? Let's pull him out of the pit. We're going to sell him to these guys. So not only are we going to get rid of him, but we'll make a little cash on the side too. And they end up selling their own brother into slavery. So here's Joseph, you know, this favored son. The kid that doesn't have to work, the kid that's always tattling on his brothers, the kid that's always lording his status over all the rest of them, and he finds himself a slave. And the Ishmaelites, they sell him into slavery in Egypt. And that's when he really begins to grow up. That's when he begins to mature. You know, it's interesting how God will often bring us to the very end of our own resources. He will bring us to the very end of ourselves. And it's only when we're at the very bottom, at the very lowest, when we've run out of any steam that we may have, that God can finally do something in our lives. And here's Joseph. You know, he's a slave in Egypt in the house of Potiphar. And he finally starts to mature. And God blesses him. And God blesses him as he's a faithful servant and the house of Potiphar prospers to the point where Joseph ends up being put over all of the affairs of Potiphar's house. Things actually start to look pretty good. And what happens? Potiphar's wife, she starts making sexual advances towards Joseph, and he says, listen, no way. He says, your husband has put me over the entire household. Why would I sin against God like this? But you know how the story goes? She eventually entraps him, takes his cloak and holds it as he runs away. When her husband comes home, he says, look what this Hebrew did. See, he came in to lay with me, and you know, I cried out, he ran away, and all I have is his cloak. And Joseph finds himself in prison. Even in prison, God continues to bless him. In that very low state, God blesses him to the point where he's put over all of the prisoners. God blesses him. Eventually, years later, after he is successfully given the interpretation for dreams for two other prisoners who were in Pharaoh's service, Pharaoh has a very disturbing dream. A dream about cattle. A dream about these cattle. They're fat, they're healthy, and then these ugly, seven sickly, ugly, thin cows, they come up out of the Nile and they devour the fat, healthy cows. Now, that's a weird dream. That's very strange. And it disturbed Pharaoh. He goes back to sleep and he has another dream. He has a dream about these beautiful sheaves of grain. They're just, you know, the kernels are full. And then there's seven, you know, there's seven branches of grain that are sickly and they're weak and they devour the full ones. And he's all wound up and he asks his own wise men for an interpretation. They can't tell him what the dream means. But one of the guys, the cupbearer, the wine taster, the one who had been in prison, whose dream Joseph had interpreted, he says, wait a minute, I remember this guy when I was in prison. And he interpreted a dream for me and for the baker. And he was right on with both of them. You want to get this guy. And so Pharaoh calls Joseph, and Joseph gives him the right interpretation. He says, listen, here's what's going to happen. You're going to have years of plentiful harvest. And then you're going to have 7 years of famine. And those 7 years of famine, they are going to be so hard that they're going to make the years of plenty that preceded them, they're going to make them look like nothing. And Pharaoh's like, well, what should we do? Joseph says, well, here's what you do. Find a guy you can trust, somebody who's wise, and during those, you know, those 7 years of plenty, you start setting aside some grain. Start setting it aside because you know that the bad time is coming. And then when that famine strikes, you're going to have grain stored up so that people aren't, you know, so that people aren't going to die. And Pharaoh's like, you know what? This is a really good idea. I think you're the right guy for the job. Think about Joseph. Here's a guy that starts out his career being sold into slavery, accused of attempted rape by his boss's wife, thrown into prison, forgotten, and now, because he's been faithful, God has elevated him to a position in Egypt where he is second only to Pharaoh. And he sets about a plan to, you know, store up the grain during the years of plenty. Well, when the famine hits, it doesn't just hit Egypt, but it hits the entire Near East. And Joseph's brothers and their families who are back in Canaan, they start to feel the pinch. And their father says, here's what you do. Go down into Egypt, buy some grain because I've heard they have grain down in Egypt. Now, he didn't know why they had grain. So you know what happens. Joseph's brothers, they go down into Egypt. And Joseph can, you know, he kind of conceals who he is from them to test them, to see if they're the same men that he remembers who sold him into slavery. And what's he do? He provides for them. He gives them grain. They buy it. I mean, they give him money, and then he tells his servants, okay, take all of their money, put it back in the sacks. He basically gives them the grain. That happens twice, and eventually he reveals who he is to his brothers. He says, bring my father down into Egypt. Bring all of your families down into Egypt because there's more years of famine coming. But I can take care of you. I'm second only to Pharaoh. I can provide for you. So go, get my dad, get your families, get your flocks, get everything, bring them down. And he sets them up in Goshen. And they're rescued from certain death during this time of famine. And here in chapter 50, Joseph's father, Jacob, has died. And the brothers start to worry. And like, you know, maybe Joseph was just taking care of us because of our dad. And now that our dad's gone, maybe the other shoe's going to drop. Now that dad's died, maybe Joseph is finally going to get even with us for what we did to him, for selling him into slavery, for making sure that he was abandoned and forgotten and sent into exile in a foreign land. They send servants. They make up this lie that their father had said, hey, please forgive your brothers. They send messengers to tell Joseph. And I love Joseph's response when he hears this message. He weeps. Joseph wept when they spoke to him. When his brothers come in, they're down on their face. Just as Joseph saw in his dream, his brothers bowing down before him, saying, behold, we are your servants. And what's he say to them? Don't be afraid. Am I in the place of God? As for you, you meant evil against me, but God meant it for good, in order to bring it about as it is this day, to save many people alive. Therefore, do not be afraid. I will provide for you and your little ones. When I was listening to Chuck this week, he was talking about fear and anxiety, something that I can relate to. And I'm not talking, when I say anxiety, I'm not talking about, you know, panic attacks. That's something that I experience, but that's not the same, I'm convinced, that's not the same as what the Bible talks about when it says don't be anxious. Because I know that when we experience those things, sometimes they're called anxiety attacks, sometimes they're called panic attacks, it's really not because I'm anxious about anything. Usually, I'm not anxious about anything. It's just all of a sudden, my body feels, you know, it's that feeling right before you get on the roller coaster. Only instead of only being for a few seconds, it goes on for minutes or hours. It's that I'm panicked. I've got to run. I've got to flee. When really there's nothing wrong. There's nothing to be anxious about. I don't know what it is in my brain or in the brain of others that causes that to happen, but I'm convinced it's not the anxiety that the Bible talks about when we're admonished, be anxious for nothing. I know that because I also experience that kind of anxiety. See, that's the anxiety that, you know, the anxiety the Bible says that I shouldn't have. That's the one when I'm laying in bed at night thinking, okay, what bills are still due? Okay, are we going to be able to pay those bills this month? Okay, what about the radio? Are we going to be able to pay those bills? Oh, okay. Oh, Carol's car has to be inspected this month. Oh, Lord, I sure pray there isn't anything wrong with that, because what if it needs brakes and rotors? It might be $400 or $500. What if she needs new tires? That could be $800. What if that's the kind of anxiety when the Bible says be anxious for nothing? That's the kind of anxiety they're talking about. A failure to trust that God is going to take care of you, a failure to trust, a failure to have that faith that God is still on the throne and he is in control. And that's what Chuck was talking about this week. And he was saying, when you reach a point in your Christian walk, and it has to do with our maturity, you reach a point in your Christian walk where you really can relax because you recognize no matter what is going on in your life, God's on the throne. That our Father, who is all-powerful, is completely in control. That's an amazing place to be. And I confess that there's so many times in my own life that that's not where I'm dwelling. Instead, I choose in my flesh, and I'll confess it's a sinful choice, I choose to be anxious instead of remembering that God's on the throne, he's in control, and he's promised that no matter what is happening, that he is able and will work everything together for good to those that love him and are called according to his purpose. And Chuck was talking about, he said when they were in Huntington Beach, he had an older lady in his fellowship, and he'd get wound up. You know, he'd be anxious about something, he'd get wound up about something, and he said she would always come. She would always kind of know when it was happening, and she'd always come and she'd say, "Now, Charles, remember, God is still on the throne." And he'd say, "Thank you. I needed to hear that. And I need to hear that. And you guys need to hear that. God is still on the throne. No matter what we may be experiencing in our lives, God is still on the throne. He's still completely in control. Nothing ever takes him by surprise. He's never shocked or overwhelmed by anything." And this is such a perfect example of how everything in Joseph's life just over and over and over again looked terrible. Sold into slavery, and how does God work that out? Brings him to a position of power in Potiphar's house. Accused of rape by his boss's wife, thrown into prison. How does God work that out? Raises him to a position of authority in the prison and gives him the ability to interpret dreams for two of Pharaoh's servants. What happens? Finally, he's second only to Pharaoh in Egypt. He creates a plan to store up food. God reveals what he's going to do. There's going to be 7 years of famine coming, so he stores up food during the years of plenty, not just so that the Egyptians can be rescued, but so that his own family, the same guys that sold him into slavery, the father who's been mourning for him for years, can be rescued from this famine and provided for. And what's Joseph say? He says, "What you meant for evil, God meant it for good, in order to bring it about as it is this day, to save many people alive." In Hebrews, we learn about what faith is. Faith is the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things that are unseen. The faith that we have, it's not a blind faith, guys. The faith that we have is based on evidence. The scriptures are full of evidence that God is on the throne and he's never taken by surprise. And he not only is able, but he does use every circumstance, no matter how terrible it is. If you're in his kingdom, you're under his control, and he's going to work it out. Just like he did for Joseph. Sold into slavery, to being second only to Pharaoh in Egypt, and able to provide for his whole family. I think about Paul. Paul knew that the authorities in Jerusalem had it in for him. They wanted to kill him. And yet, Paul knew that God was leading him back to Jerusalem. Remember at one point, one of the prophets comes out, takes his belt, binds up his hands, and he says, this is what's going to happen to the guy whose belt this is. He's saying, "Listen, Paul, you go to Jerusalem, you're going to be taken prisoner." And Paul's like, "Yeah, that's what's going to happen. But that's what I have to do." And what's the result? Paul is taken prisoner. He's brought before magistrates. And what's he do every time he comes before somebody in power? He testifies about the gospel. Paul ends up on a boat, and the boat is crashed into rocks off the shore of Malta. That seems like a pretty bad deal, right? Everybody on that boat is preserved, but they're shipwrecked on Malta. They're all wet, they're cold, they're all gathering firewood. Remember what happens to Paul? He's getting firewood, and a poisonous snake comes up, bites him on the hand. And all of the, you know, people on the island, they're saying, "Oh, this guy must be a murderer. He escaped the shipwreck just to be killed by this poisonous snake." And what's Paul do? He just goes over to the fire and he shakes it off into the fire. And they're all watching him because they know he's going to swell up and croak any minute. Now, can we agree that this is a pretty terrible series of events for Paul? Guy's arrested. He's imprisoned. He's shipwrecked on his way to Rome. Gets bitten by a poisonous snake. That testimony of the gospel probably never would have reached the people on the island of Malta had God not orchestrated all of those events. When Paul is eventually imprisoned in Rome, he's able to write in his epistle, he's able to say, you know what? All the household of Caesar, they all send their greetings. Paul was able to testify in Rome, and people in Caesar's own household came to faith. Because what the religious leaders in Jerusalem meant for evil, God meant it for good. There were people on the island of Malta that God wanted to see get saved. And so what's he do? Lets Paul be arrested, puts him on a boat, crashes the boat, and then Paul's able to testify in Malta. There were people in Caesar's household, people in Rome, that God wanted to see saved. And so what's he do? He preserves Paul through that whole experience and gets him to Rome and then has him imprisoned in Rome so that he's able to minister and testify there. Over and over and over and over again in the scriptures, we see it. Terrible things happen. And every time, God successfully uses it. It's almost as though he knows in advance what's going to happen and works things out. Well, that's exactly what the case is. And so whether what you're facing this week, today, whether it's something natural, like, I don't know, a foot of snow dropping down on your county, or whether it's maybe a human agent that's got something against you, maybe somebody is slandering you at work, or maybe you have a relative that can't stand you and is backbiting. You know, whether it's a natural agency or whether it's a human agency, whatever it is that either our enemy, the devil, or one of our lowercase e enemies, whatever they're trying to do for us that they mean for evil, we can be confident today that God means it for good. That no matter what's happening, no matter what's going on, God is going to work it out for his good and ultimately for our good. God is still on the throne. He's fully in control. He's never shocked or surprised, and we can trust him. And that's one of the reasons why we have the scriptures, is so we can see all of those examples. And I can look back on my own life all these times when I thought, you know, just terrible things had happened. And I can look back and see how God has worked them out every time. And why there are still times in my life when I choose to lay awake in bed being anxious when I don't have to. And, you know, it's always easier to tell other people. I've told you guys a story before, a time when we were all experiencing really severe attack. It was early in the radio ministry. And I remember Carol and I laying in bed. We were both awake. And I remember her saying, "Why is this happening? Why? Why is all of this happening? Why are all these terrible things happening?" And I remember just saying to her, I said, "You know what? I don't know. Here's what I know. God's good. God's in control. So let's just go to sleep." And you know, I really need to say that not so much to Carol, but to myself every night. When I start getting all wound up about things that are going on, everything that could possibly go wrong, things that are going wrong. You know what, Stowe? God's good. God's completely in control. So just go to sleep. And I'm convinced Chuck is absolutely right. When we can dwell there in the sure and certain knowledge that God's in control, that he loves us, then we can rest. And that's the rest that Jesus promised us. And that's what he wants for us. Let's pray.